he is, I think that he's in trouble.
We will find your man, okay?
What is it that I've done that makes me the enemy?
The Tourist.
You may not remember, but I do.
Watch all episodes on BBC iPlayer.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Nina Stibbe was 50 when she first became a published writer with Love, Nina, a collection of letters she wrote to her sister about her time in the 1980s working as a very inexperienced young nanny for Mary Kay Wilmers, editor of the London Review of Books. She found herself running a home where Alan Bennett often appeared at supper time and other famous neighbours and people would pop round, though Nina had often no idea who they were. Her affectionate, witty memoir won Non-Fiction Book of the Year in 2014 and was adapted by Nick Hornby into a television series for the BBC. Alan Bennett, Nina, was often giving you culinary tips, wasn't he? What was the best recipe he suggested?
Well, he wasn't so much giving me suggestions for new things as much as trying to repair food that I'd already made. So I remember once he said that I shouldn't really put tinned tomatoes into my stew. He would often turn up with a salad that I hadn't asked him to bring. And, yeah, we bickered quite a lot.
After nannying, you went on to work in publishing and then moved to Cornwall with your partner and children. Since the success of Love, Nina, you've written 6 more books, 4 of them novels. Your latest, Went to London, Took the Dog, charts your first return to the capital for 20 years. Taking a break from domestic life, back in Cornwall, or perhaps a fresh start altogether. Well, Nina, we're going to hear music by Handel, Mozart, Benjamin Clementine, but first Brahms, and I wonder why this piano concerto?
I picked this because I love it. I love the horns at the beginning. There's such a call to attention. And then you get that lovely piano that gets quite stormy. I just love it.
Thank you.
The opening of the Piano Concerto No. 2 in B-flat major by Brahms. Lars Vogt was directing the Northern Sinfonia from the piano. Brahms was very good at openings. All the symphonies have wonderful openings. And that piece, as you say, wonderful use of the horns.
Yes.
What do you think when you hear something like that?
I'm very moved by music. And I was one of those very lucky children that was born into a family of real culture lovers, music and drama and literature. Those things came at us all the time. My mum played the piano herself and played often, and we'd hear her playing Bach, Clementi, Chopin, that kind of thing. And she would find a tricky bit that she couldn't master, and she'd go at it again and again and again. So it wasn't just that we'd hear her playing beautiful pieces, we'd hear her learning.
Did you learn a musical instrument?
I was at school in the 70s, and at primary school there was a really good music education system. We had instruments that we could choose from. The only requirement was that you did a year of recorder. But I don't think I had the brain for it. And I remember the first piece we had to learn in my little group was a piece called Go Tell Aunt Nancy, The Old Grey Goose Is Dead. Do you know it?
Yes.
It's hideous. It's so gloomy and horrible.
Mm. You don't feel like giving us a rendition.
Go and tell Aunt Nancy, go tell Aunt Nancy, go tell Aunt Nancy, the old grey goose is dead, the one that she was saving. And so it goes on. So it's a really sad, grim story, and it slightly put me off. After that, we obviously started piano lessons because it was that kind of family. My sister and I used to go together. And I couldn't tell you the name of the piano teacher we first had, but we called her Mrs. Play the Blighter, because that's what she used to say to us. She'd open the door, she'd look absolutely miserable and disappointed that we'd turned up. And then we'd go into her front room and she'd take one of us into the music room and she'd say, go on then, play the blighter. And it was grim.
I'm beginning to understand why you have such an affection for humour as the way through all of these things, because there was obviously rather a lot of sadness. I mean, after all, your parents divorced when you were quite young.
Very young. I mean, I don't think I was miserable about them divorcing, because I think I was so young I didn't really realise. Mm. I remember learning the word divorce and that it was the reason for many things, usually bad things, and why children weren't allowed to play with us in the playground because of the divorce.
So it was ostracising.
Yet it was in those days, late 60s, early 70s, a family that was divorced was seen as, you know, a broken home, a failed marriage, and families without the guiding hand of a man were to be feared, really.
You moved with your mum and your siblings to rural Leicestershire.
Yeah.
Did life change a lot?
Life did change. It was a mistake. My mum shouldn't have done it. She thought we would have this lovely life with ponies and fresh air. But actually, everybody was a bit suspicious of her and they wouldn't really make friends with her. There was a little bit of, oh, I'm not allowed to play with you because of the divorce. Certainly people weren't allowed to come around to our house.
It seems amazing now, doesn't it?
It's just extraordinary, yeah.
I mean, not so long ago.
Not so long ago. And I remember my mum had to apply to be allowed to sign her own cheques without having them co-signed by a man. And luckily her father was a lawyer and fixed it for her that she could sign cheques.
You wrote about some of these experiences, albeit fictionalised, in your novel Man at the Helm, which has a degree of irony to it.
Yes.
Your mum was terribly lonely.
Yeah.
In her early 30s, four children, Labrador dog, all to look after. You write, it was no wonder she became a menace and a drunk and a playwright. I mean, were you worried about her as a child?
The novel you've just talked about, I've got this lovely narrative arc of us children being terribly worried about her. I don't remember being that worried about her in reality. I was always hoping she'd meet a man and get married.
Well, didn't you and your sister write to eligible bachelors to try and prompt that?
Yeah, we did have a few men in for her. Mm. We were very keen that she would remarry and we'd have a man at the helm and then we'd be accepted again and we could join the Brownies, because we tried to join the Brownies and our names never got to the top of the list. So we did become very interested in her remarrying. And she was very young. I mean, she had four kids and was divorced probably by the age of 26. And that made her quite vulnerable. And it also meant her loneliness was really horrible, because she was still young and hardwired to be with other people her age, and it was very difficult. But it did mean that she was fun. She listened to a lot of music. She listened to a lot of classical music, but also popular music.
So you were all seeking eternal source of light divine.
Yes.
Which is your next piece.
That's my next piece. I've chosen that because it's one of my very favourite pieces of music. It's actually the kind of thing my father would have listened to more than my mum. My dad loved the sort of macho Wagner and choral music, and I just love it.
Well, it's a birthday ode for Queen Anne,
yeah,
by George Frederick Handel. Beautiful piece.
The musical instrument talking back to the voice. I love that.
We all think of a trumpet as being blaring and loud. But there, that Baroque trumpet, beautifully played by David Blackadder, was managing to really have a duet with the voice, as you say.
Yes, it's astonishing to me. It's somehow measured.
We heard Eternal Source of Light Divine, the birthday ode for Queen Anne by Handel, performed by Ellen Monaghan Thomas. As I said, David Blackadder was playing the trumpet with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by Harry Christophers. That was very much the kind of music your dad might have liked if he was to go to the Baroque age.
Yes.
He came from a wealthy Dutch Jewish family with a sort of machine interest.
Yes, they'd come over from Holland for tax reasons. They had a very successful knitwear machinery business, I think my father was the third generation of the Stibbys, if you like. Mm. And he'd only known being very, very rich and very successful. And obviously, I don't remember living with him, but I would go and visit him on the odd weekend.
Did he provide generously for your mum?
Generous while it worked. Mm. She, for some reason, decided to take shares in the business as her part of the settlement, which was great while the business was doing very well. And then the 1970s got going and the business, I don't know if it went bust, but it certainly went terribly wrong and we weren't so well resourced anymore.
However, your mum did finally find a boyfriend.
Yes, she did. Being one of those women who'd been very, very well educated but not trained to do anything, her brothers had been trained to be lawyers and actors and vicars and things, she went and worked on a laundry van. She actually drove the laundry van. She's a very good driver, very keen driver, and delivered those roller towels to pub toilets. And she would drive like the clappers with her van boy. They'd get to the Bull's Head. They'd rush out, go into the toilets. They'd shout, coming in, you know, do your zips up. And she would then collect all the dirty towels and go back to the depot. The new boyfriend was the traffic manager at the laundry. Just as she was sort of posh and middle class, he was very ordinary. He'd worked his way up and there he was, this handsome man. And she was this sort of tearaway who kept going through the clutches in the vans. And so he sort of came into our lives and he was very different to the kind of people that she'd been mixing with. And one of the differences was that he would listen to Radio 2. He brought this wonderful other whole new strand of music to us. But at the time, yeah, we were a bit snippy about it.
I think you have the new boyfriend to thank for introducing her and you to Jake Thackeray. Such a wonderful voice he had. I always wish we heard more of him.
Yes, they both loved him. And he was incredible. He was sort of Jacques Brel meets Tommy Trinder or something.
He became famous through a regular spot on BBC television. He would contribute a song every week or so.
Yes, we found him wonderful. Of course, he was incredibly good-looking. Mm. Very easy to listen to because you could hear every word because he had that clipped delivery.
Yes, it almost became colour to his voice, the clipped delivery.
Yes.
What are we going to hear then?
Well, I've chosen, it's not the most obvious one, but I've chosen a song called Remember Bethlehem. Mm. It's not one of his funny ones. I mean, he is a very, very funny performer and a bit bawdy at times. But this was borderline for me, Michael, because this can make me cry because I find this incredibly moving. It's the Christmas story.
It was awfully cold. She was far away from home. She was not very old. She was only a shabby little country girl. So long ago. It seemed so far away, so far away. But even so, I know your nightingales remember her still. Your pussy willows and your daffodils. Even your stony old hills remember Bethlehem. She was ever so weak, and the journey'd been hard. She had nowhere to sleep. She lay down in the small dark farmyard so long ago. It seemed so far away, so far away. But even so, I know your lowly hedgehog knows what it means. Fish that twitch in your greeny streams, even your shaggy old trees remember Bethlehem. When she lay herself down, she must have been afraid. There was only the ground. She had a baby in a painful darkness so long ago. It seems so far away, so far away. But even so, I know that the rain was there when her time had come. The wind won't forget what the girl has done. And even the sulky old sun remembers Bethlehem. When she looked at the child for the very first time, I suppose that she smiled, and it's my guess that Mary cried a little so long ago. It seems so far away, so far away. But even so, I've got the flesh and the blood to remember them by. Him in me mind, her in my eyes, and every reason why I remember Bethlehem, Bethlehem, Bethlehem.
Isn't it gorgeous?
Mm-hmm. And so many pieces that you've mentioned and that we all like have a phrase that just sticks in the mind. So yes. Far away, far away.
Yes.
And it's a kind of key to the door, isn't it?
It really is. His lyrics as well, the poetry of it. You know, she gave birth in painful darkness. It's just beautiful. He really was a genius and a very unique performer.
Remember Bethlehem from Jake Thackeray, from the album Jake in a Box. Now, in 1982, aged 20, you moved to London to become a nanny, Nina Stibbe. Tell us about the family that you were working for.
The family I chose very carefully, not for any other reason than that she was a single mum. I didn't want two bosses. I thought just one grown up in the house is enough for me. She is Mary Kay Wilmers, was then the deputy editor of the London Review of Books. What was extraordinary about the place that I didn't realise at the time was that it was this street of the most accomplished, incredible people in the media and culture and film and telly. And, you know, we'd got Alan Bennett living across the road, who was a very good friend of hers, Claire Tomlin, the celebrated biographer, then the literary editor of the Sunday Times, Jonathan Miller up the road. I think he'd just launched his Rigoletto. We'd got Joan Thirkettle, the newsreader, across the road, Don Warrington, the actor, and really many, many more. And now, of course, I look back and go, wow. But at the time, I didn't know who they were.
And amongst the looking after, there was quite an important job, wasn't there? Because Sam had Riley Day syndrome, a hereditary disorder of the nervous system. And he was one of the sons of the film director, Stephen Frears.
Yes. The boys I looked after were Sam and Will. And at that time, primary schools weren't at all inclusive. So the only way Sam could attend a normal, in inverted commas, school was if somebody went into the school three times a day to give him medicines. So this is why she really needed a nanny. And of course, I got very close to Sam, and he's still one of my best friends.
Now, it was at this point that you started writing letters to your sister,
yes,
Victoria, telling her about your London life. Was it partially to sort of impress her with what was going on?
It was entirely to impress her. She hadn't left, so she was stuck in rural Leicestershire working in a nursing home. But I was very much wanting her to know how happy I was, because I was very, very happy immediately there. So I had no idea who all these Alan Bennetts and Jonathan Millers were, and I knew she wouldn't know either. So I remember at one point I said, oh, there's a chap that comes in for dinner every night. He's Alan Bennett. He used to be in Coronation Street. Because I knew then she'd think he was important. If I said he's writing cutting-edge television drama, she wouldn't be interested in that at all.
You said there was this wide divide between the world you came from with your mum and dad and then the boyfriend, for example, and Jake Thackeray. And I wonder where you feel you fit into that.
Well, it's very strange. Can I just say the boyfriend is now the husband? Let's not keep calling poor Alan the boyfriend.
Right.
It's very strange. I was very much the outsider and I was looking at it with sort of open eyes. I was amazed at them. I wasn't interested in their accomplishments at all until later. But I was astonished by the fact that none of them seemed to be able to reverse park. Or, you know, they like this very strange Chinese tea that I didn't like. I found them fascinating because they had such odd tastes to me. They wore such odd clothes. But the biggest thing was that they were more interested in me, the nanny, than I was in them. So we'd be sitting around a table having dinner and they'd want to know about my life. And after a couple of years, I went to Thames Polytechnic to do my degree because people there in that world had said, you know, you should go and do a degree, you're bright. And so off I went, and then I'd come back in the evening, even though I wasn't the nanny anymore, I still lived in the house. And they'd say, you know, what's going on? And I'd say, well, we've been learning about Hegel or Wittgenstein. And they'd want to hear my views on it. They were extraordinary people. They are extraordinary people.
Do you think it was that otherness to a certain extent that meant you got on very well with Mary Kay?
Yes, I do. Both of my parents remarried and had more children. So rocking up in London and these two kids, it was nothing to me. I just slotted in and I felt like an older sister to them. I didn't take my nannying duties very seriously at all. I remember at one point Mary Kay said, if you're not going to do any cleaning, I think I should get a cleaner. And I was annoyed. I thought, oh, for God's sake, are you going to get a cleaner? That's embarrassing for me. But I said, yeah, I suppose you should. And she did. But I was an outsider. And yeah, that is probably why it worked.
So you weren't in any way rocking the boat?
No, I wasn't rocking the boat. I was having some wonderful opportunities given to me to go to see the sort of culture that I'd seen in the first half of my childhood. Before my mum was a van driver and we had a bit of money, we would go to the theatre all the time.
But it is Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat that you've chosen next.
It is. One of the shows I got to see with the boys was Guys and Dolls. I was just completely blown away by the whole production. It was fantastic. Afterwards, somebody must have given Sam a cassette tape and he played it every day for a year. So we know those songs word for word, inside out. So I had to choose one of the songs. And I think it's what they call an 11 o'clock song, where there's a sudden change in fortunes for the protagonist and we're going to move into the finale.
I dreamed last night I got on the boat to heaven. And by some chance I had brought my dice along. And there I stood, and I hollered, someone fade me. But the passengers, they knew right from wrong. For the people all said, sit down, you're rocking a boat. People all said, sit down, you're rocking a boat. And the devil will drag you under by the sharp lapel of your checkered coat. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat. I sailed away on that little boat to heaven, and by some chance found a bottle in my fist. And there I stood, nicely passing out the whiskey, but the passengers were bound to resist. For the people all said, beware, you're on a heavenly trip. People all said, beware, beware, you scuttle a ship. And the devil will drag you under by the fancy tie round your wicked throat. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat. And as I laughed at those passengers to heaven, a great big wave came and washed me overboard. And as I sank and I hollered, someone save me, that's the moment I woke up. Thank the Lord. And I said to myself, sit down, you're rocking a boat. I said to myself, sit down, you're rocking a boat. And the devil will drag you under with a soul so heavy you'd never float. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat. Sit down, you're rocking, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat.
It's a very catchy number.
Just joyful.
Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat by Frank Lesser, sung by Stubby Kay from the original Broadway cast recording of Guys and Dolls. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the writer, Nina Stibbe. Nina, the book Love, Nina is full of wonderful details of conversations. When Alan Bennett would drop in for supper, what kind of things would you chat about?
Everything and anything, but we would never chat about work. He wouldn't talk about writing plays and Mary Kay Wilmers wouldn't talk about editing her paper. We just talked about our daily lives and it was really quite dull but lovely.
He was quite good at fixing things.
Well, he denies that, but he really was, and he was terrific. I mean, we'd have a problem with our tumble dryer or the fridge freezing food at the back and he'd explain why things had gone wrong and he'd fix it. If we had a puncture, he'd fix it. He's very, very handy.
And, of course, your sister kept the letters. So
yes, she
that's
did.
How you were able to compile them.
She kept them because I had illustrated them. I'd write, you know, Dear Vic, oh, they're all crazy on herbs. They go mad for this herb, basil. And then I'd draw it. And because I'd gone to that trouble, she felt she couldn't throw them away. Sadly, I did throw her letters away.
Did Mary Kay and others take some persuading about the kind of details that you revealed? And I was thinking of your latest book too, whether you find people, on the whole, are flattered perhaps to be mentioned, but rather nervous about how they're described.
Yes, well, with the first book, everything I'd written about was 30 years ago. So even though I might have said Mary Kay's eyeliner made her look like Alice Cooper, it was so long ago that even she could see the funny side. I mean, she did have misgivings about me publishing that book and she took a bit of persuading. She was a little bit worried about Alan Bennett being in it so much and would he regret it? But he was very happy with it. I think the more she read them, the more she enjoyed them and realised that people would like them. And I think it's done her proud.
And, of course, you don't spare yourself in your writings.
No, never. I'm very fair. I'm never mean, but I am mischievous, but I'm equally hard on myself.
And you actually treat all kinds of subjects that are not taboo, but some people would find awkward.
Yeah, I think that's true. And certainly with my latest book, I talked a lot about menopausal symptoms of my own and my friends. And I went into a lot of very candid detail. People don't seem to mind. I think as long as you don't have them being cruel to animals, they like to exist. They like to see themselves.
Mozart next.
Yes. I heard a performance of it in 2018 at the De Montfort Hall, when I was awarded an honorary doctorate from Leicester University, the highlight of my life so far. I was so thrilled. I'd left school at 15. I'd got an E for my A-level that I'd studied on my own. And I'd gone and done a degree by the skin of my teeth. To be acknowledged by my home city was really something. And I was reluctant to talk about it because it sounds a bit showy-offy.
No, but it's a wonderful example, I think, to people that it's always possible. Everything
yes.
is possible.
Well, it's that. And also, it's a reminder how important our higher education institutions are. I had to speak to the graduates. And I'm never in that position. I never have to speak seriously. I'm never asked to do that. And it was such an honour. I can't remember now whether the magic flute happened just before I spoke and it made me feel very happy and confident, or whether I'd finished it and then we had this wonderful performance. But anyway, I love it. I love this bit.
Well, it's reflecting on joy, isn't it?
It is. The birdcatcher talking to the princess, and they're talking about love, but not for each other.
We heard by Manon, Welke Liebe fühlen, from Act One of The Magic Flute by Mozart. The soprano was Elisabeth Norberg-Schulz, the baritone Wilfried Garmlich, and the Budapest Filoni Chamber Orchestra was conducted by Mikhail Halas. In Love, Nina, you're helped in your literary endeavours by somebody called Mark Nunney, who lived up the road.
Yes, he had already done his A-levels, and so he was the person that was teaching me how to study. And he was very good at not doing the work for me, but he would encourage me. He and Mary Kay Wilmers between them were why I went and did a degree. They both agreed I should go and study more because I was clever, and I was very clever. Just I hadn't been educated. We still read the same books at the same time.
Well, we haven't said that he became your husband.
So, yeah, he became my husband. We got married about 6 years ago, but we were together for a while. Then we weren't together for about 10 years. He went off and lived in Europe. And when he came back to London in 1999, we got together and very quickly had two children.
Alfred and Eva.
Yeah.
And in 2002, you all moved to Cornwall. What prompted the move away from London?
Because Mark had been living in rather exciting places where he could swim and ski, and he loved surfing. So we went to Cornwall, supposedly for a year or two, but we ended up staying, as people often do.
Now, despite the fact that it's an incredibly popular piece, the next music, I don't think we've had it on Private Passions. It's Better Is Peace from The Armed Man, A Mass for Peace by Carl Jenkins. How did this come into your life?
My mum still is a member of the Leicester Philharmonic Choir, and they were putting on The Armed Man in Leicester de Montfort Hall, conducted by Carl Jenkins. It's brutal in many ways. In order to depict war, there's that incredible percussion all the way through it. And then this, the piece I've chosen, Better Is Peace, is very mesmeric or something. I play it a lot in the car. I sometimes glance in the mirror at my dog and I think she knows it. I play it so often, this
Peggy,
bit.
That would
yes,
be.
Yes, Peggy, my cockapoo. Well, she's very fussy about music. She doesn't like too much percussion and she doesn't like the harmonica. Yes, not that there's a harmonica in this, but, you know.
We'll have to invite her on.
Thank you.
The final part of Better Is Peace from The Armed Man, a Mass for Peace composed by Carl Jenkins and performed by the Hertfordshire Chorus and the London Orchestra da Camera, conducted by David Temple. Your most recent book, Went to London, Took the Dog, is about leaving Cornwall to return to London 20 years after you left. And you describe it as a year-long sabbatical.
Yes.
Looking back now, what do you think really prompted the return?
What prompted the return was having gone through the pandemic and feeling very isolated in Cornwall, my children having left home to go to university, both of them in London, feeling just too far away from them. They're grown-ups now, but they're still young. And then I just completely accidentally fell into this opportunity of living with the writer Deborah Moggach as a lodger.
So it's the second time, actually, that you found literary lodgings.
Yes, lodgings in London with a literary lady.
And how did you find yourself adapting to life in London after Cornwall?
I found it unexpectedly difficult. And, yeah, it took me a long time to find my feet. I think I'd changed. I was blaming London. I said, oh, London's changed. It's different. I can't cope. But I think I was different. I was no longer in a job. I didn't have that lovely routine and people to see, things to do in a timetable. I was sort of wandering around like a rich tourist, which was inconvenient because
but,
I'm not.
But time to write, presumably.
Well, I wasn't in the right frame of mind, really, to write. I was writing the diary, which, you know, I didn't know we were going to publish it, but I was quite, I'd almost say manically. I was writing and writing and writing so that I could make sense of this time in my life.
The next music is by one of the Beatles.
Yes. Well, the Beatles, hugely important in my life. I had a young mum. She adored them. And then I remember the Beatles splitting up. And I must have been seven. And it was doom and gloom. It was horrendous. Everybody was terribly upset. Even my grandparents, who were quite classical music fans, and my father loved the Beatles. And then I remember Paul McCartney's first solo album. He was back, and it meant so much to my mum. And I remember the beauty of the object. In my head, it's a whitewashed wall with a bowl of cherries, and the cherries are sort of spread out, and the cherry juice is in the bowl, and it's bright sunlight. And then on the back or inside of it, there's a picture of Paul, and he's in a sort of a sheepskin coat. His baby is in the coat, peeping out. And it was just such a glorious image of a man.
He had a very fruitful relationship, indeed the Beatles did, with George Martin.
Yeah.
George was able to show them how to write for string quartet, how to use brass instruments in Sgt. Pepper, all that kind of thing. And clearly it rubbed off on Paul because he made a version of this piece for string quartet.
Yes, and I didn't know which to choose. You're talking about Sing Along Junk, because I've chosen Junk. And I chose Junk to hear his voice. But actually I play Sing Along Junk more, the instrumental. Both are gorgeous.
Bicycles for two, broken hearted jubilee, parachutes, army boots, sleeping bags for two, sentimental jamboree. Thank you.
Junk by Paul McCartney from his debut solo album, McCartney, released in April 1970.
I honestly think that Paul McCartney, probably along with James Herriot, is responsible for women's unrealistic expectations of men because he's so perfect.
So how did you come, Nina, across the final piece?
Luckily for me, my children became teenagers and they were finding their own fantastic music. My son found Benjamin Clementine, who is a contemporary, incredible composer and artist. And he said to me, my son Alf, he must have been about 15 at the time, "Mum, I've got to go and see this man in concert." And of course, we lived in Cornwall. We've got to go to Bristol. I felt so delighted that Alfred was so passionate. We drove up and stayed in a travelodge overnight. And my mum heard we were going. And she's so brilliant. She'd heard of Benjamin Clementine. And she said, "Well, yikes, I'm going to come with you." So I ended up on a school night watching this extraordinary performer. And I just glanced to my 15-year-old son and to my then 78-year-old mum. And I thought, how lucky am I that these people just keep bringing me this music? And it was one of the most astonishing gigs I've ever seen.
Well, the piece has a certain restlessness about it, which is summed up, I think, in that line, "I will be forever chasing it all till the very end," which is a nice note for me to say thank you very much, Nina Stibbe.
Thank you for having me.
Adios. Adios. Adios to your afternoon. Cause tonight I'll be forever following the Colosseum moon into a certain room. Adios, adios, I'm sorry for quickly jumping into the train. I waited but no one came, you were just too late. That decision is mine, that decision is mine. So let the lesson be mine, let the lesson be mine. That decision is mine, that decision is mine. Cause the vision is mine, the vision is mine. Adios. Yes, goodbye, adios. Adios to the little child in me who kept on blaming everyone else instead of facing his own defeat in Edmonton. After all, I should have no regret, for if it wasn't for my mistakes I made yesterday, where would I be by now? That decision was mine, that decision was mine. So let the lesson be mine, let the lesson be mine. That decision was hard, that decision was hard, but the vision is mine, the vision is mine.
I'm taking my bags and I'm going down Silver Street, taking the train. I know very well, and angels, they come and go. You know, last time I met an angel, but then, you know, she left, and I don't know the things about angels anyway. You know, sometimes you think that you know more than you know, but you actually don't understand. Anyways, when they come to me, they sing to me so beautifully. If I can recall their melodies, it goes, excuse me to take your time, but it goes something like this. Thank you.
lest the trees cease breathing, lest the bees cease breeding, and all the salt in the Dead Sea ferments to honey. Until then, I'll be forever chasing, chasing, chasing it all to the very end. That decision is mine, the lesson be mine, 'cause the vision is mine. The decision is mine, the lesson be mine, 'cause the vision is mine.
Adios by Benjamin Clementine from his 2015 Mercury Prize-winning album, At Least For Now. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the writer Nina Stibbe. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael will be talking to the biologist and fungi expert, Merlin Sheldrake. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. Rishi Sunak has confirmed the government is looking at legal options to help clear the names of sub-postmasters who were wrongly convicted as a result of the Horizon IT scandal. More than 700 of them were found guilty because of faulty accounting software. Fewer than 100 have had their convictions overturned. The Prime Minister said his Justice Secretary was considering options, including whether the Post Office should be stripped of its role in the appeals process. Mr Sunak described the scandal as an appalling miscarriage of justice and said it was important for the victims to receive compensation. The Prime Minister's denied that he previously had doubts about the government's flagship policy to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda. Number 10 documents seen by the BBC suggest Mr Sunak wanted to scale back the plans when he served as Boris Johnson's Chancellor in 2022. King Abdullah of Jordan's warned the US of catastrophic repercussions if Israel's military campaign in Gaza continues. He told the visiting US Secretary of State Antony Blinken that Washington should put pressure on Israel to agree to a ceasefire. Mr Blinken is on a week-long tour of the region to try to prevent the situation deteriorating further in Gaza. Thousands of RMT workers on the London Underground will begin a walkout this evening, which will see little to no services run this week. The stoppage is part of an ongoing row about pay and conditions. The RMTs described a 5% pay rise as unacceptable. Transport for London says that's all it can afford. Czech television is postponing a new series of a crime drama that was due to start tomorrow because one episode features a school shooting. 14 students and staff were killed by a gunman at Charles University in Prague last month. An actress travelled more than 150 miles yesterday to sing the lead role in Evita after both the leading lady and understudy fell ill. Jessica Daly's trip from Middlesbrough allowed last night's performance at the Curve Theatre in Leicester to go ahead. And the weather this afternoon, mist and fog will struggle to lift in the north and west, particularly in Scotland, where it will be dense. Elsewhere, a mix of variable cloud and bright spells. There'll be lows of 2 degrees Celsius in London, minus 1 in Cardiff and Edinburgh, and 1 in Belfast. BBC News.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
Fancy a new routine for 2024? Why not wake up with BBC Radio 3? Ditch the abrasive alarm clock and start your morning like this.